Session number 847, Bernard McKenna, Reel 1.
Isn't it? February 37.
February 37.
Yes, about halfway through, I think.
How it was that you came to go?
Well, two answers. I was an active member of the YCL. I had been for a number of years, at least 3 years. I think I was, I think all were idealistic, but I think what particularly got me, but probably got others as well, was we were oppressed by the inevitability of the spread of fascism. It seems to be growing up, Hitler and Mussolini, and things seem to be spreading, really were getting worse. And when the war broke out in Spain, I thought, well, this is just another step in the fascisation of Europe. We did all the usual things that were going in Manchester. We were pretty active in getting medical supplies, food supplies, political meetings. But personally, it didn't seem to be enough to me. One or two went of the YCL members. I think to that extent it was catching. And I had no personal commitments, so there's nothing really to stand in the way of me going. So I think this, the decision sort of arose naturally out of the situation at the time. I wasn't the only one who went, I wasn't the first who went. When I went, I was the only one from Manchester, I think, well, I went on my own, met others. I met a chap from Leeds, I think, another from Liverpool. And at that time, as you remember, there was no closed border. You simply contacted the CP, or went down to London, got the night train on a weekend excursion through to Paris, got into Paris, made a contact there, and just got on the train. By this time we'd assembled in numbers, and I arrived in Paris about 5 o'clock in the morning, as I seem to remember. I was a bit surprised that the French didn't speak French up to my standards. I had trouble in finding my way along, but by the same evening I was on the train to Figueres. And by that time there were several hundred. It had mushroomed. I went out with, I think, three people. This chap from Leeds, who was middle-aged, and the chap from Liverpool, who was middle-aged. I can't remember the chap from Leeds' name, and all the man from Liverpool, his name was Croston, and he lost a leg later on. I came across him. He lost a leg and came back fairly early. Anyway, that was it. Arrived at Figueres and stayed at the barracks there for 2 or 3 days, and again made a train load of volunteers, and we travelled down to Albacete.
When you first had the idea of going to Spain, how did you go about it then? Did you mention it to party comrades, someone in the party?
Oh yes, I mentioned it. Local party secretary, Ms. Jenkins, said I'd like to go, and he said, have you any military experience? I said, not at all. I had served in a sort of cadet unit of the local territorial army, which met locally. I'd done that a few years earlier, more or less when I was 15, 16. And I said, that's all I've got, but anyway, a few days later I said, yes, off you go.
How far did you realise what you were going into, looking back on it now?
I didn't. I didn't expect it to be a picnic. I didn't expect to gain anything out of it. I think you view the thing anyway through idealistic spectacles, and you do it. You reck not of the future cost, just of the immediate impulse. It was, actually, it wasn't an impulse, it was something that developed over several months. It took 6 months for it to develop, you know. In the meantime, people had gone as early as September, October, when the earlier brigades were formed. So it was somewhat slow maturing, but I felt so helpless at doing anything here that would be effective. I thought it would be more effective over here. Looking back, it's somewhat naive, but as far as I can remember, that's the way I felt.
Yeah.
It's something one does, and that's it.
You, were you working at this time
before
you went? So you gave up your job and just went, what were you working at?
I was a warehouseman and clerk in a small textile firm in Manchester. So it wasn't a big job, it wasn't an important job. But it was a well paid job. And so I don't think I was sacrificing.
You
weren't, think,
weren't good. What age were you when you went?
21.
21. What did your family and so on think?
Well,
about
this
you
was
doing?
One of the where my conscience was a bit prickly. I daren't say I was going. I didn't feel like saying I was going, so I compromised. I didn't tell even my friends. I remember going to YCLD, I think, on the Saturday before I left, and one or two quite probing questions asked me, especially by, I think, my girlfriend at the time. Her brother had gone to Spain, and he was later killed. And there's a few probing questions, but I couldn't really answer them. So as far as my parents were concerned, I got as far as London and posted a letter from there announcing that I was off and wouldn't come back, not to worry. But worry they did.
Yeah. I see.
Even in those days, there's a bit of, I can remember, they were approached by reporters from, you'll never guess, the Daily Mail. They were doing a bit of searching out, chasing up the families on volunteers, and they tried to make out a wicked conspiracy of in which innocent young youths were, innocent young men were sort of talked into going volunteering for this thing, sort of white slave traffic in effect, and I don't think they got much satisfaction.
Yeah.
But I do remember when I came back, I saw a very bad picture of myself in the... Oh, my mother sent it. That's right. It was in the Daily Mail, and with a very prejudiced report, you know, about a deluded youth, something along those lines. And but even in those days, they seemed to have this idea.
On that, could I ask a question?
Yes.
Do you remember at this time, was your experience the same as mine, that far from inciting you to go to Spain, my experience was that first in London and then in Paris, we were interviewed, told how horrible it could be.
Oh, yes, yes.
Mm. And that if any of us wanted to withdraw, nobody would approach us.
I'd go even further than that and say when we arrived there, the route was always free, for you to walk out and come back. This was, I think, one of the things that held one there, the fact that you were always free. There was no compulsion, you were always free to come back. In fact, George Brown's brother had come back just before I went. He'd been out and come back, and...
nobody.
And George Brown himself later went out just after, about a month after me, and replaced him, sort of thing. He felt it incumbent upon himself. I felt very annoyed about it. I thought he was somebody, a most vital person. He was more use in Manchester in the movement in England, certainly in Manchester, where he was honoured and respected, I think, above any other local comrade. And that's with no disrespect to him. He had something about him. And I think he felt impelled to go because of his brothers going out and returning, sort of keep the family end up. So... that was some time after I went, but I remember talking to George Brown's brother and discussing, you know, things in Spain, so I was quite aware to some extent,
mm-hmm.
although how aware can you be until you've actually mm-hmm. experienced
that's
it, you know,
thing,
but
yeah.
It certainly it wasn't anything like PC Renner joining the Foreign Legion or anything like that, or even the kids I met later when we were in the Air Force, starry-eyed and wanting to fly off into the skies and kill the wicked Germans. There was a lot of that, you know.
Yeah.
I found it.
Learn a trade.
So, oh, there I was, on the city.
Mm.
And I think this is my own experiences. Diverge you from the general. I say I went out with these two chaps, and we were supposed then to go to Madrigueras, not as it got down here, Madrigueras, which is the brigade, the British unit training base. The Americans also had a training base at Taranza, I think.
Tarazona.
Yes. Reasonably close by. Mm. Albacete was the centre, but the French were pretty well in control of it at that time, and the language is French. And when did you go out, Bob, was it?
Hmm?
When were you out?
September. They refused to let me go, but eventually after I got out of the next...
37, place. Yeah.
September 37.
Mm. Did you get the impression at the time that everything was largely French, the whole organisation, the materials,
not so
the
much
logistics?
When I got there, and by this time Tarazona was a British...
American, wasn't it? Tarazona. Madrigueras.
Colonel Johnson was the commander of the base, American.
Mm.
Mm.
He'd been in charge of a disciplinary battalion of bad boys in America. He used to tell me this. But he was a good bloke, stern, you know. But once you got to know him, a thoroughly good bloke. And I think he was genuinely concerned about every man. He wanted to put me to the officer's school, actually. I was there. Before I left, he sent for me. And he said, when I told him, I'd made a promise to Harry Pollock before I went out that I would get to the battalion as quickly as I could. So he said, you did. And he said, you budding commissars, you're all the same. Come out here, you can't get to the front quick enough, and in 5 minutes you're a corpse. That's exactly what Peter Carrigan had said to me many months before.
Mm.
Kicked me back from Glasgow, humiliated. Said, you're not going. I know you, you'll be a corpse in 5 minutes. So that also brings out that nobody forced you to
That happened to George Brown, you know, first day in battle at Brunetti, that's right, he was a corpse.
Smashing mine, I'd known George incidentally. I lived with George in 1931-32 in the Soviet Union.
In the Soviet Union? You were down here then?
In the Soviet Union, I like that. I was with him for 13 months in the Soviet Union.
Oh, I see, that's
In
1931-32.
That's when I met him.
He was at the school with you.
And he was a smashing lad. He was what I would call every inch a man in every sense of the word. And along with that, he had, and I don't mean this in the wrong sense of the word, not in fancies, he had charm, he had personality.
We call it charisma these days, but he had it.
But
he had the earnestness of purpose, and nobody was too unimportant to talk to. He talked to everybody. He talked to me. I would argue about philosophical ideas, intellectualism, and ask for great words and great ideas, but he would argue with them and relate them to practical political terms. And even when it was often inconvenient to himself. And I think he was the one, you know, really stimulated me. That's why I felt so mad when he came out. But by that time I was separated from them, and I didn't meet up to him till Brunetti. And the day just after we met up, he was killed. I was wounded, he was killed, and along with a lot more Manchester lads at the set. At that time. But anyway, I got to Albacete, and I travelled In Figueres, we'd started basic military training, then marching, forming, handling weapons, not firing, but just the routine manoeuvres. We did about 3 days there while we assembled. And even then, I was assimilating internationalism because a group of Americans came over and I wondered why, what they were doing there. They really were upper class Americans, you know, yeah. Really. What they had given up, they were so equipped. I think I had a small bag of raincoat and a change of clothes. They got everything, grips, fur coat, Mackinaws, hats, officers' trousers, you know, these leggings, everything. Money, self-importance. Two, I remember talking up with. Yes, they were pilots. They were qualified pilots. They were going out to fly the Air Force. That was it, you know. And one of them was the son of a very prominent left-wing lawyer woman, his mother, in America. He'd given it all up. So he was out there, and I think all nationalities were moving in on us. So by the time we left Figueres, even after, I think I was there just over a week, went to 10 days. I can't remember. We really swelled up. And,
could I ask you?
And I met a good friend, a Canadian. His name is Isidro Barcena. Now he was a Canadian, a Spanish Canadian, from Cuba, settled in Canada, and he was worked as a partner in a cigar dealing business. So he'd given that up, and he's a lot older now. He just come along. He felt he had to do something. He was one of the kindest, gentlest men. I knew, and his importance to me was I didn't know any Spanish, and he put me, you know, he spoke it, obviously, it's his language, and he put me in touch with it, and also the customs of the people, you know. So we went down together with this Leeds chap, Liverpool chap, formed a little group, and when we got to Albacete, was sort of lined up in the bullring, I think it was. We marched into the bullring, and I think they're going to divide us, send out the British to Madrigueras, and they had a special announcement. Was anybody who had any knowledge or interest in electricity, radio, thing, come along, and they got an important job to do. Now, I was a radio enthusiast, you know, and I knew quite a bit about it, actually. And so I said, oh, have a go. And Barcena came along with me, so we pushed forward, because he'd worked as a wireman, apparently, a telephone linesman in Canada, yes, and in his youth, and he knew quite a lot about things. The other two chaps went on to Madrigueras. Now, we joined up with a motley crew, some Italians, some Frenchmen.
Were you communications then?
Well, they just asked us to do what they thought was a job. I thought, well, we'll see what happened. So they stuck us in a little caserne at one end of Albacete. It was run by a sheik. And there they got a whole mountain of stuff that had apparently been pulled out of the harbour out of a sunken ship. It was all wet. Telephones, French army telephones, exchanges, wires and everything. Even radios, field radios, and we had to go through them quick, strip them down, get them working, and get the stuff that was useful to one side and all the junk to the other. So before we did anything else, the next thing I knew, I settled in there, and they were still shot. Well, while they were rousting up, we were working, actually, all morning from pretty well daybreak till lunch, military training and tactics, all afternoon and all evening as well, stripping this stuff down and assembling it. And I thought, well, this, you know, this is my first taste of military glory. We stuck at it and had a very lively, active French commissar who came down, took over the unit along with this Sheik commandant. Now, this Sheik was a good chap. He was only about 5 foot tall. He was a bundle of energy. And because he never stopped, nobody else stopped. And so there it was. And we were up at dawn, and we were doing field marches, moving about, all sorts of military tactics, weapon training as well, rifles, grenades, the whole French manual and the whole Czech manual and every other bloody manual rolled into one. So. And assembling and sorting this stuff. So anyway, brother, this went on for weeks, and we were organised more or less as a military transmission unit. So I stuck with them for quite a while, and then I moved into Madrigueras, stayed there a week or two, and then went up with the British unit to their base camp just outside Madrid. I don't remember the name of that little place. I asked Sam the other night. He didn't tell me. It's one of the... Most of the names, funnily enough, I can remember. That little one, the little rest camp, where they came out from Atahuarama and settled down, that was their base. We came back, everywhere we went in Spain, he came back to that and rested and refitted. He went there, and then I was a sort of infantryman, carried a telephone. I helped with an exchange, and two of us carried a spool of wire as well. And then we were on a truck, and then up into the mountains towards Escorial, the Guadarramas, ready for the march on Brunetti. The next few days, it was sort of sitting up by day and moving up by night. And all that was done on foot till the opening of the offensive. And there on the first day of the offensive, it was a lovely sight, standing on the hills and looking down over the plain and seeing the artillery attacking, the planes going over, little chateaus, and the tanks going forward. And us following. Yes. I didn't follow very far, only 2 or 3 miles across the plain. Outside, the British were moving in on Villa Nueva de la Cañada. We were moving up. And I was on the right, trying to organise telephone lines from where we started from in the gully, moving up on one side, and we ran right into it. I got a bullet in the foot. Fortunately, it wasn't permanently damaged. It laid me low. I didn't know I'd been wounded, just hung up. And that was it. The next, I tried to take a step. Well, I cried, oh, Christ. I lay over there. Anyway.
Did anybody know that you were wounded?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I wasn't alone. We're moving in this group. And I could see the British battalion up ahead, just moving into the streets of the village, you know. And. Anyway, some Spanish, call them first aid men, grabbed hold of me, stuck me on a mule, like across a mule, and just started working me backwards. I don't know which hurt worse, the bloody pain of the wound of being jolted up and down on that mule, and I must have gone for bloody miles. And then I got to a field ambulance where they gave me another wound, a great big dose of anti-tetanus, and the which was worse, stuck it in my thigh, and bandaged me up, and I sat there for 2 or 3 hours. And then evening, they ran me into Madrid, which I suppose was didn't take long. I got into the hospital in Velasquez. That was the same that Maurice Levine ended up in, he'd been wounded in the shoulder. And the same bloody night, it was Bond. Madrid was bombed and part of the hospital. And so I was panicking. Another lad, I think, who'd gone out from Manchester, Huey Barker, was there. Little sandy haired lad. You remember Huey Barker? Freckled lad, yes. Is he still around, is he?
I don't think he is.
No.
I've been down to Manchester a few times since then.
I've not seen him.
Well, he could be fairy, too, you know. He never dissembled if he was annoyed with anyone, he would tell.
Anyway, that was my first experience. Now, Mollish was evacuated off in an ambulance the following morning. The ambulance was full of the wives who had joined him, I suppose. he got on before I could. He could walk, I couldn't. And anyway, it was only a slightish wound, a machine gun bullet through the foot, and it went more or less in the heel, just sliced through and just sort of barely grazed the bone. And within a week, I was all right. You know, I could limp. Couldn't walk, but I could limp, and I got a stick, and I went moving round Madrid, and this wasn't was a bit of a peculiar hospital, a sort of emergency civilian hospital, and they treated soldiers, but we're only sort of part of it, and nobody seemed to be very concerned with us. So as soon as I was fit, I thought, I'm getting out of here. I had only a little money, so I got some ran some advice. She said, oh, you can get a room. There's an hotel and stay there and contact. I contacted some, I don't know, it was an IB unit, a Spanish Army unit, a combine unit. I can't remember this particular part, but I got some money out of them. So I went along to the Gran Via and did a bit of enquiry. And they said, oh, the internationals will stay at that hotel, the biggest hotel on the Gran Via, which is the biggest street in Madrid. I was right by the standard telephone building, you know. And it's a marvellous place. You know, two or three Midlands rolled into one. There's only one thing wrong with it. Every morning that attracted the shells. Yeah. And all the back part of the hotel was missing. So you went up into a luxurious room, a lovely bed, and every morning you got up and dived down as the shells began to fall. They hit the back of this hotel, and you got down quick and got a breakfast and then got out. And if you're lucky, you might come in the evening and find a sort of very... hunger was really striking in Madrid, you know, you could no food at all. You might get a sort of watery soup and a bit of vegetable, a bit of goat's meat, and live on that. So I lived on it. But trying to get food, apart from odd bits of bread and sausage, bocadillas they call them, remember, those little things, and you're lucky to get those. Grim, and I had no source of rations. I was more or less a civilian. I suppose if I had money, I could have stayed there. Anyway, I got so fed up. I decided to get back to the front, and I more or less hitchhiked back and worked my way. The only thing was that I had on a pair of black trousers. The technical uniform was all bloodstained, and lost it. I had a white shirt and a pair of black pants, and that was all. I was hoping to get re-equipped when I got up there. But by the time I got up there, the battalion was in the line, and I remember going back in the middle of the day with the food wagon right across this plain. It was being shelled like blazes, and the truck darted this way, that way, the shells are falling there, and it really was a bit grim. And then I got back to the base, and I got back the day before they got out. That was bloody foolish. Anyway, the day we left at dawn, and we started withdrawing in the night, actually, as dawn broke. We were on the road back to Madrid in the foothills of the Guadarramas. Yes, it was Guadarramas, somewhere near Escorial, and one road about as wide as this running across, hills on the other side and a flat rocky plain on the left, and the aviation, the fascist aviation came over and bombed us to hell. We scattered, we heard them coming over, of course, and the trucks were got out of quick, they drove off the road, they all scattered among the rocks, and they bombed us, bang, 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 and that was when Nathan was killed. I wasn't far off.